Hello and welcome to Every Woman. I'm here today as your hostess, Fiona Nalling, with my wonderful co-host who just passed their programmer's test, so congratulations and welcome, Anthony.
Hello.
And with my wife who's applauding from behind the engineering board.
Hello.
And we're also here with a wonderful guest on the phone who is Professor Chenal. She's from Vanderbilt University, and she does research in employment law, labor economics, and legal and economic history. Her research has hit newspapers and been reported quite widely over time because she has examined the effects of obesity on the labor market and how the legal system can address these effects. Other current research focuses on the employment effects of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Americans with Disabilities Act Amendments Act of 2008. Professor Chenal, thank you for being on our show today. Could you give our
listeners... It's nice to be here.
Thank you. Could you give our listeners a bit of background about yourself other than the couple of seconds I gave them?
Sure. So I'm a law professor at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. My research is really intersectional in nature. I'm both a lawyer and an economist, so my research is primarily looking at what's happening to women in the labor market data and then thinking about how the legal system can address the inequities that women face in the labor market.
So what made you actually focus on employment discrimination in law?
You know, I think I've always been very interested in discrimination issues, labor market discrimination more generally. I think I was always particularly interested in gender discrimination because I was raised by a mother who was an attorney, and when not a lot of women were attorneys, and certainly not a lot of women were, working after they had kids. My grandmother worked after she had kids, so I come, in a sense, from a long line of working women, and I think that I've always been particularly sensitive because of that to gender issues in the labor market. And so, you know, while I have done work that's a little bit broader than just gender discrimination, in particular, I have some work on disability discrimination. I think it's why I come back to gender discrimination first and foremost. Over and over again. And, you know, I think particularly being in academia, which continues to be very much a male-dominated field, even though I'm appointed in the law school, I am an economist, and economics is very much still a male-dominated field. I realize that, gender discrimination is very much an ongoing issue in the labor market.
And I'd like to actually read a snippet from a recent article on a scandal involving the Midwest Writers' Workshop to lead us into the next section about obesity and weight discrimination. The Indianapolis Monthly did a great article on the scandal approved by the person at the center of the issue. And a volunteer and author, Sarah Hollowell, was nominated to the board. She was unanimously approved by a vote, but somehow was not added because she was overweight. And the exact quotes from the article at the time said when she was nominated, "But one woman wondered aloud whether Hollowell was right for a position as board member given what she looked like." Heacock interrupted. "I'm sorry," she said. "Looks like what exactly?" According to Heacock, the board member replied matter-of-factly, "So fat, it's disgusting." And that's the end of the quote. I see lots of articles about women being body shamed or clapping back online against their body shamers. I can't think of a single example I've seen involving any men. I found your research and other similar studies on employment discrimination against obese women really interesting. Could you tell us how you realized that was an area that needed investigation?
Sure. Sure. So, historically, it's been difficult to research obesity and weight in the labor market simply because there's not a lot of good data out there. Most of our big labor market data sets, they have some demographic information, but not necessarily your weight and height. So even if there had been interest in the past in researching weight discrimination in the labor market, actually doing the empirical research was just simply impossible to do. That really changed about 15 or 20 years ago. We started seeing just a couple of the big labor market data sets include information on weight and height, and that's what made my research and some other research that's similar to mine possible. I think as far as why I was interested in pursuing this, what got me interested, I think it's impossible to grow up as a woman and not realize how important your appearance is and how people are constantly commenting on it. And I think weight even more so. In a way that's simply not emphasized for men. I mean, and it's not just it's not just targeted at overweight women and women who are classified as obese. It's targeted at women across the spectrum. I think I always tell this anecdote, but I grew up in ballet, and I loved dance, and I still enjoy watching it, but even at a young age, if you're a girl enrolled in a dance class, your weight and how your weight is compared to your peers is very much going to be mentioned, noticed, etc. I think that there's a lot of intuitive appeal to studying weight and weight discrimination, and I think that it's why results like mine that we see in the data that demonstrate that women experience a lot more weight and appearance-based discrimination in the labor market make a lot of intuitive sense.
And while I was actually doing some research about your research, I saw some other articles that actually said that guys, to a certain point, as they gain weight, actually gain income. It's actually the reverse of the discrimination up to a certain point.
That's right. So, typically the easiest way or the most common way that researchers classify individuals are based on the medical definitions of body mass index. Body mass index is simply a weight to height ratio. Based on your weight to height ratio, you might be classified as normal, underweight, normal weight, overweight, obese, or morbidly obese. What we know about men is that there's not really good evidence of any sort of wage or employment penalty until they become morbidly obese. So that means a body mass index of 40 or higher. Just to put that in perspective, if you're 5'4", that's going to be about it's going to be close to 300 pounds. That's just simply how the ratio works out. Whereas what we know for women is that as soon as they move from the normal weight BMI category to the overweight BMI category, they start to see real wage and employment barriers in the labor market that men simply don't see. In fact, what we know from the data is that the highest earners and the most likely to be employed among males are overweight men. So overweight men have the highest employment rates, and they also earn the highest hourly wages. But there's really not a penalty for your weight as a man until you reach that morbidly obese category. And even then, it's far, far smaller than the penalties experienced by women who are classified as obese.
I think some studies have found that there's even just too much of a focus on women's bodies in general, even if whether or not they are obese, typical sized, you know, under the norm, and so to speak. I came across a fascinating study that looked at trade magazine covers, including Time magazine, for instance, from 1965 to present, that showed anytime a woman was portrayed in a photograph, she was much more likely to have her entire body shown, or in some cases, her body without even showing her face, whereas men were almost entirely shown from just the waist up. There was this emphasis on women's torsos in there, regardless of their weight. It seems to me that there's almost really an unhealthy focus upon our bodies in a general sense, even. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. And, you know, we know, I think most of us realize anecdotally that, you know, when you see a small child, people tend to praise small female children as, oh, she's so pretty or she's so beautiful. It's about their appearance. Whereas a small male child or a male baby, you know, people might say, oh, he's cute, but really, it starts from childhood, right? Where this focus on women's appearance that simply gets worse over time.
Do you think some of the increase in income for overweight males may be because people often tend to gain weight as they get older, so they're more mature in their employment field, or do the studies control for that factor?
Yeah, so all the studies control for all relevant demographics. So basically, you know, my research and other similar research takes into account and holds constant other demographic variables. So that's going to include things like age, but also education. And in fact, it also holds constant race and ethnicity, right? So one of the things that you know, we know from the data on obesity is that historically disadvantaged racial and ethnic groups are more likely to be obese than are non-historically disadvantaged groups. And even when we take into account your race and ethnicity, we still see this strong obesity penalty for women that we don't see for men. However, what that means is that if you are an African-American female, for example, the penalty that you experience is going to be greater for being obese than it would be if you were a white female, just simply because if you're an African-American female in the labor market, you're going to be penalized for being African-American. You're going to be just statistically more likely to be obese, and then you're going to be penalized for being obese. So you sort of get a double penalty, whereas if you're a white female, you know, the only penalty that you would experience is the penalty for being female, of course, and then if you were obese, you would experience additional penalties. So all of these penalties that you hear about in the news, whether it be because of gender or because of race, most economists are controlling for other demographic variables, and the penalties you hear about, they just simply compound one another. So if you associate as a member of more than one historically disadvantaged group, then you would experience potentially multiple wage employment penalties in the labor market.
By penalties, do you mean what people are discriminated against for, and what the discrimination is the penalty, where it's not actually anyone's fault, it's just this discrimination that's happening, and what types of those discrimination are happening?
Well, so, you know, every type of discrimination is different, right? And one of the most difficult things about studying discrimination from an academic perspective, particularly nowadays, is that most people will not or will no longer explicitly admit their bias, right? Now, I will say that obesity is an exception. It's just like the article that you started the show with. There are plenty of people who will explicitly still admit to you that they are explicitly biased against overweight and obese individuals. But, you know, as far as gender or race, you know, it's not politically correct anymore. And so, you know, of course, we've seen some public exceptions, very public exceptions recently. But for the most part, most employers are not going to admit and may not even realize that they're biased for that matter. And so, you know, what the empirical data allows us to do is see that nonetheless there is bias happening in the labor market. What we can't tell as well from labor market data, experimental data allows us to get at this issue a little bit more, is what the mechanism is, right? Are people implicitly biased? Do they realize whether they're biased or not? Are they conscious of their bias? Are they biased because they've bought into stereotypes? Are they biased because of a personal experience? I mean, unfortunately, that's the type of that sort of question we can't answer as well with labor market data. But my own sense is that, you know, the answer to those questions depend quite a bit on what type of bias you're talking about. But I do think that that at least with respect to weight and obesity, a lot of what's going on in the labor market is still fairly explicit in nature.
And I did actually see a brief study last year from Fairy Godboss, and that showed that only 15% of hiring managers would actually consider hiring an overweight woman, with many of them making comments along the lines of they look like they're lazy or unprofessional. Do you think that's a big source of why overweight women, unless because they get a start in a career later or get pushed to a less appealing career because of those negative attitudes?
Yeah, so that's the real insight. I think the real distinction between my research and some of the other research on obesity in the labor market. So what we know from what I showed in my research is that the obesity penalty for women is sensitive to the type of job that you're in. So what we know is that the women are most penalized for their weight. In what I call personal appearance or public appearance jobs. So you can think about this as any sort of job that requires you to be the face of the company. That could be a receptionist because you're the first thing that people see when they walk into a business. That could be a higher level position where you're you know, just forward-facing and client-facing. Conversely, the obesity penalty is smallest for women in physical activity jobs. Now, the interesting thing about physical activity jobs is that they are typically, just as a whole, the lowest-paying jobs in the labor market. They're very hard work. Most physical activity jobs, you know, things like daycare workers, home health care aides, really hard jobs to do, and very low paid as well. So I think the real insight of my research is that it is fairly industry specific, but we know that the highest paying jobs in the labor market are the ones, on the whole, are the ones that are forward facing, client facing, these personal appearance jobs, and that's what's really hurting overweight and obese women in the labor market.
And because of the stereotypes about overweight women, people in general, they don't want the company to think they're unprofessional or that they're a lazy company, or is it just they want people to be as visually appealing to grab people just like they do in adverts?
I think it's a bit of both. I think that employers are very sensitive to their company being visually appealing. That being said, we do know that from psychology research that people very quickly associate overweight and obese individuals with stereotypes like laziness. And so I think that those are probably going on.
And for our listeners, could you give us an idea of the size of the impact to someone's yearly salary or wages if they're overweight or very overweight?
Sure. So it's about 5 to 10%. That may not sound like that much, but you know, if you make $40,000 a year, that might mean that, you know, you land in a job, if you land in a job at all, you land in a job that's paying $4,000 a year less, which is a lot of money, and it's a meaningful amount of money, especially when you're considering that that we're holding constant everything else you can hold constant. So really, we're comparing apples to apples. Obese and morbidly obese women are being paid 5 to 10% less than normal weight women for doing exactly the same job.
And that's an incredible amount. 5 to 10% is significant. $4,000 could be the difference between paying for childcare for that year or having to have it come out of other resources, for example. And I would imagine that there's also an impact for the promotion opportunities as well.
That's right. So we know that the penalty extends not only in terms of wages, but it exists for hiring and promotion as well. So that's why I made the caveat of, you know, if they get the job in the first place, right? So a lot of obese and morbidly obese women in particular are simply not given the opportunity to get a job in the first place. And if they do, their likelihood of being promoted is substantially reduced.
Yeah, some of the articles I saw talking about these studies had individual examples where they'd interviewed people. And there was a case where there was a receptionist and she gained as little as about 13 pounds, and she got transferred to work in the mailroom in a much poorer paid and much nastier conditions job. And then another example was a woman who was actually hired as a manager for a sales team, and she kept not getting any projects given to her or any of the plum positions and plum accounts, which of course meant then she wouldn't get any of the really good bonuses, and she lost perhaps again as little as 10 to 15 pounds, and suddenly they started giving her all the projects that she should have had, and she got promotions and raises, and she looked back and the only thing that had changed about her was she had lost weight.
Yes, I think that there's you know, as I said earlier, I think there's plenty of anecdotal evidence to support what we see in the labor market data that's going on, and there's simply no other explanation for it besides weight.
Is there anything that can be done legally? Does the fact that this weight discrimination affects women but not men mean it can be a Title VII issue?
Yes. So, you know, my basic answer is yes in theory, but there's not a lot of legal actions going on presently. So just to give you a bit of an overview of what liability for weight discrimination looks like, So there's one state, the state of Michigan, that explicitly bars weight discrimination in the labor market. Several years ago, in fact, a female who used to work as a waitress at Hooters actually sued Hooters for an adverse employment action because she had gained weight while she was a Hooters waitress, and sued under the Michigan statute. But that statute is unique to Michigan. There are also several cities in the United States that have local remedies against weight discrimination in the labor market. These tend to, probably not surprisingly, be very liberal cities, very progressive cities. So there's, for example, San Francisco, Washington, D.C., and there's a handful of others. Other than that, it is not illegal, at least explicitly illegal, to discriminate on the basis of weight. So if you think that you've been discriminated against on the basis of weight, you have to, and you want a remedy under a federal statute, you have to frame it in one of two ways. So a lot of legal advocates starting about 10 years ago tried to frame weight discrimination as a form of disability discrimination that violated the Americans with Disabilities Act. Some of those lawsuits have had success. The ones that have involved individuals who were morbidly obese on the body mass index scale, so individuals who would never have applied to individuals that would just be considered overweight on the body mass index scale. The only individuals that have been successful are morbidly obese individuals, and there are also plenty of morbidly obese individuals who have not been successful under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I think what my research and other supporting research has really suggested is that perhaps the correct remedy is not under the Americans with Disabilities Act, because there are plenty of overweight and obese individuals who are not limited and certainly wouldn't consider themselves disabled. And this really does seem to be a primarily female issue, which you're exactly right, sounds like potentially a violation of Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which prohibits gender discrimination in the labor market. The real problem with bringing a Title VII lawsuit from a proof perspective is that as a plaintiff, in order to win, you would have to prove that your employer treated weight in women differently than your employer treated weight in men. And while you might suspect it and while you might have some comments to suggest as much, gathering the type of evidence that you need to actually win an employment discrimination suit can be difficult, especially when you're trying to prove, you're trying to gather enough comments to show that, and examples to show that your employer was fine with overweight and obese men, but not fine with overweight and obese women. And so that's really been the challenge to Title VII suits based on weight discrimination cases going forward.
I understand that a similar problem is not available. that a similar problem comes up with women that are discriminated, that are disabled, from a different article that you had, but they're having an even harder time because they're two different bills. Is that correct?
That's right, and that actually comes, that's again in many ways a proof problem, although a proof problem that's really been created by federal courts in this country. So federal courts historically have been hostile to what lawyers called intersectional claims. That is the idea that, that you're discriminated against because you're a member of two or more protected classes at once. And instead, the way that federal courts think about discrimination claims is a discrete claim. So, for example, if you are an African-American female, and you think that you've been discriminated against because you're an African-American female, you would have to prove that you couldn't prove that it was because you're an African-American female. You'd have to prove that you were discriminated against because you were African-American, separately from your proof that you were discriminated against because you were female. And from a practical perspective, that can be difficult, because even if you have smoking gun statements from a supervisor or an employer that suggest that they were hostile towards you because you're an African-American female, sometimes those statements include words that are both offensive to women and offensive to African-Americans. And so trying to prove race discrimination separately from gender discrimination becomes a really difficult issue. So analogously, and you're right, what I've worked on some is the issue of disability discrimination. So what we know both from labor market data and Equal Employment Opportunity Commission charge data is that disability discrimination is worse for women than for men. That is, both wage and employment rates for disabled women are worse than those for disabled men. It's the same proof problem that faced by disabled women, is that they can't try to prove their disability and gender discrimination claims simultaneously. Instead, they have to prove it separately, and just trying to do that from an evidence perspective can be quite challenging, and often can be the difference between a winning and a losing case.
That is a very compelling point, and there's so much more we want to talk about with you, Professor Chennault. We're going to take a brief musical break here at the bottom of the hour, then we're going to return to continue the conversation with Professor Chennault about the way that women are treated in the workplace based upon their bodies and not their abilities. Hello and welcome back to Every Woman. You were listening to a song called Glitter Rain by a local artist, Laura Schaefer. This is her first appearance on the radio. We wanted to highlight her beautiful song that she wrote and performed for us here. And Laura, I know you're out there listening to us. We're very grateful that you could share some of your art with us. Professor Chennault, we have a caller on the radio named Anthony from North Kansas City. Anthony, you're on the air.
Hello to you, and hello to your guests and the KKFI listeners. Unfortunately, the law is not protecting people from discrimination. It should. I think if the laws, number one, required that based on your age and your education, everyone that's in that particular job or position should all be paid the same. They could easily make laws to and enforce them if people would report it. But where it gets kind of tricky is establishing a prima facie case. Under the 1964 Civil Rights Act, it says you shall not discriminate on the basis of race, color, creed, sexual orientation, whatever. But I think they could avoid a lot of that if they just had a standard wage. For example, if you're a manager at a Hy-Vee or Walmart, there's a certain wage. Everybody gets that wage. Or whatever their wage rates are now, they just need to kind of come together and work on making a wage that's going to be fair for everyone and enforce it. And that's the problem right there, is enforcing the law. Because a lot of these people, lawyers, will put up civil rights shingles, and then when you talk to them, they don't want to do the work. And so it's unfortunate that that still takes place. It's more unfortunate that with this current president, it's going to get a lot worse. People are going to get more criminal records, and they're not going to be eligible for a lot of things. And it's just sad to see this country go in the direction that it's going in, and it doesn't seem like we're making forward progress on establishing equality. And I'll hang up and listen to your guests. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for phoning in, Anthony.
Well, going to that item, I mean, you can't necessarily say everyone should get paid exactly the same for the same job, because if someone's had 10 years in that job, they've got on-the-job experience that puts them ahead of someone that's been doing the job for 2 years. And also, often many jobs have how well did they perform in that job. And I bet it's items like that that really bite people that are overweight, because the manager's got a subconscious bias they don't even know about a lot of the time, thinking that someone is overweight and therefore is lazy or doesn't represent the company well just because they've got a bias against how they look. I'm sure that must really play into things, Professor Chennault.
That's exactly right. So as much as, you know, it sounds intuitively appealing to pay people with the same title, the same age, the same education, even the same experience level, the same amount of money, look, we know that all workers aren't created equal. And, you know, a manager at one Starbucks, one manager at one Starbucks may be a whole lot better at her job than a manager at another Starbucks, just simply because she's more motivated, because she's more productive, because she's better at managing a team, etc. And economic theory teaches us that at base that, you know, that at performance-based pay is a good thing. So that's a real barrier to having sort of strict pay scales across age, education, title, and experience. Now, of course, we know that there are places, even in the United States, that do pay that way. I mean, a lot of government jobs pay that way, right? They don't pay based on performance. They simply pay based on what's your title and how long have you been here and what's your highest degree completed. So that's a real problem with structuring employment discrimination laws in that manner. But one other point that I wanted to raise that was raised by the caller that I think is an important one, I'm going to take a slightly different perspective on it, but I think it's an important one to raise in terms of employment discrimination enforcement in this country, is the following. So it is increasingly difficult to find a lawyer who will bring your employment discrimination case for you. Why is that? Simply because these cases are very procedurally complicated to litigate. They are very long to litigate. So the way that employment discrimination cases work, at least if you're bringing a case under federal law, is that you first have to go through a charge process with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. That typically takes more than a year before you're even allowed to file a lawsuit in federal court, which takes many years if the lawsuit goes to trial. And even though under employment discrimination statute, if you're successful, you can get attorney fees. It is such a long battle and a long road that the damages that you're going to get on the other end are just simply not worth it. Now, part of that is because under Title VII, under statutes like Title VII, damages were capped by Congress in 1991. So the amount of compensatory damages that you can get are based on 1991 caps, and you can imagine that those caps have not risen with inflation. And so the payoff for the time and effort that you go and the anguish that you go through to actually litigate a meritorious employment discrimination case is often not worth it based on the payoff at the end.
I was actually going to ask you about that, about how hard and lengthy discrimination cases can be, because I've had friends that have lost their jobs for other types of discrimination and have been advised that it will take years to get anything if they even do.
That's exactly right. So Many of the employment discrimination cases that we see nowadays that are meritorious are brought as class actions, just simply because for the lawyers involved, and frankly for the plaintiffs involved, the only way that the payoff is worth it is at the end is if you're bringing a group claim. Probably the biggest employment discrimination case that we've seen in the last few years is the Walmart v. Dukes case. Now, of course, that class action was ultimately unsuccessful, but it's indicative of the trend in employment law because it's simply the only way to make it financially feasible, both for lawyers but also for plaintiffs as well. One of my favorite stories to share is that Lilly Ledbetter, who very famously brought a case against Goodyear Tire Company for unequal pay for doing exactly the same work. I've met Lilly Ledbetter. She has, she's done a lot of interviews on TV. If you've never seen her, but she's very compelling, and she is. Really wonderful at describing just how hard it is to be a plaintiff in an employment discrimination case and how punishing it is to be a plaintiff in an employment discrimination case and an employment discrimination case where the facts are on your side. Even when you are in the right, the system is such that it is not an easy road to be an employment discrimination plaintiff in this country. And as a result, we see a lot of people with meritorious cases just simply decide, you know what, it's not worth it. The cost in terms of time and money is just too much for me to go forth with this.
And especially if you're still employed at that company, that must be make things very awkward for any possible future employment or fair consideration of meritorious raises.
That's exactly right. So it certainly, if you're still employed at the company, it makes it quite awkward to go forward with any sort of suit. But, you know, even if you are not still employed at the company, unless you have another job lined up, a lot of plaintiffs are very hesitant to go forward against their former employer, especially if they want to work in the same industry, because they don't want to be blackballed in the industry as the person who brought the employment discrimination suit. They're worried about their reference checks. So even if you move to another company, there are very compelling reasons why you might be hesitant to pursue any sort of action against your former employer.
We have to take a short break to acknowledge some of our wonderful supporters for just a minute, and then we will be right back to finish up our incredible session with Professor Chenal here on KKFI.
In appreciation of support for over 30 years, KKFI invites you to join us for our 30th anniversary celebration, Saturday, June 30th at the Folly Theater, featuring two all-star bands backing up over 20 artists, including The Elders, Gerald Trimble, Cubanisms, Eve Sheldon, and more. Mingle with DJs and hosts, enjoy a KKFI history presentation and founders panel, and party like only the KKFI community can. Tickets starting at just $15. For more info, including the VIP reception, go to kkfi.org/events.
Hi, this is Bill Sundahl with KKFI. Thanks so much to Meshuggah Bagels for sustaining our volunteers during this last fund drive. We appreciate it a lot when a family-owned business supports KKFI. For the last 3 years, Meshuggah has been supporting KKFI, and we want to thank all the staff and the Lindy family for keeping your community radio volunteers fed. Thanks, and we look forward to a long partnership.
And you're back with Every Woman, and we're talking to Professor Chenal about her research into the effects of discrimination on obesity and women. And I, what advice then would you have to someone, given what we were saying earlier about how hard it is to sue, even if the facts are on your side? What advice would you have to someone who felt that they were being discriminated against because of their weight, or because they're a woman, or both?
The best advice is to collect as much evidence as you can. So to document everything. Every comment that's made towards you, every time you notice a supervisor, employer, treating somebody who's not obese differently than you, write it down. The best thing that you can do for the purposes of an employment discrimination suit is gather as much contemporaneous evidence as possible. It will help you not only in the EEOC charge process, but if you were to go forward with a lawsuit, to do that as well. So if you think you're being treated differently, keep your eyes open at work and document everything. And look, no one wants a lawsuit, right? So before you think that you have to file a discrimination charge, go to your human resources office and talk to them and bring the evidence that you have gathered to them and see if it can be resolved internally first, because certainly that's the best outcome before you have to resort to the legal system. But really, it's just about keeping your eyes open.
And given how hard we said it is to attack things legally, is there any thing that can be done to help affect and change the cultural mindset of weight being an issue that drives down wages and that affects people, particularly women?
Sure. So I think it's really about getting the message out there that so much of weight is genetically determined. And what we know from the scientific research is that even to the extent that your weight is environmentally determined, not genetically determined, what we know from the scientific research is that once you reach a certain weight for evolutionary purposes, our bodies are built to maintain that weight because, you know, for thousands of years, humans were trying to gain weight, right? We were struggling to get food. And so our bodies are built to maintain the highest weight that we achieve. And why does that matter? Well, a lot of people think that if you're overweight or obese, you know, if you just tried harder, you could lose weight. And in fact, what we know increasingly from the scientific research is that regardless of why you reach the weight that you did initially, your body will literally fight you for the rest of your life if you try to lose weight. And I think that really changes people's perspective on this weight issue, that it's not something that's about self-control or that you can easily change. It's not something that should be a source of blame. And I think that once we really start to change the conversation about not blaming people for their weight, I think that that will make all the difference.
I know I've heard white men say that they feel like they're the only category that it's okay to discriminate against, but I've definitely heard overweight friends bemoan how they get treated, and particularly in the dating arena as well. And I can't understand why that is. They're such wonderful people. And if like I've got a pet cat who's massively overweight. I have tried to diet him, but he is still amazingly cute and wonderful to me. I don't understand why people look at other people and say they've got weight, so therefore they're not worth associating with. It doesn't change them. I guess there's no
real
question.
Well, that's right. And in fact, we know from another study that that particularly overweight and obese women are their marital partners are less successful in the labor market in the labor market. And so, if you're overweight and obese as a woman, you're already not going to earn as much and have a hard time getting a job. And because it appears that a lot of the dating market is also shut off to you, you're more likely to marry a partner who is going to be less successful in the labor market, which in some sense, you know, compounds the penalty, or even further restricts the economic resources available to you.
Thank you so much for sharing your time and your knowledge with us today. Maybe we'll be able to discuss it further in the future with hopefully happier news.
Yes, let's hope so. Happy to be here.
Thank you. And now I need to remind people that they are going to be able to stay tuned to hear Donna Wolf coming up with Urban Connections. And after that, we have MC Richardson with Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City. And that they'll be able to hear Every Woman again next Saturday at 3 o'clock. And you have been listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And we're going to finish up here with just one more song from local artist Laura Schaefer. This is called Fear Run 1.